Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about heart disease. And certainly one of the things that we know is that heart disease is the leading cause of death and a major cause of disability in both men and women in the U.S. today. This is sort of a bad news, good news thing. That part is the bad news. The good news is that we have a good idea what the risk factors are for heart disease and that it is something that is both treatable and preventable. So this morning, what we want to do is, as we have occasionally done here on the program, look at the basics of heart disease, talk about the risk factors, talk about those things people can do to try to reduce their risk, and then also talk about what is the current state of the art in terms of treating heart disease. And of course, if you have questions, you can call in and ask. And our guest for the program is Dr. Martin Lipsky. He's a family physician. He is the regional dean at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, Eckford, and he is one of the authors of a recently published book that is titled The AMA's Guide to Preventing and Treating Heart Disease, and Wiley is the publisher. So if you're interested in this subject and you'd like to have a good one-volume reference that we'll talk about all of the things that we'll talk about this morning, you can go to the bookstore or to the library and look for the book. And of course, you can use this program as a resource as well. We invite your questions at 333-9455. Now, that's for people who live here in Champaign-Urbana. So if you're local, use that number. We do also have a toll-free line. That means no matter where you're listening, if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or on the internet, you may use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. And just one thing that I would like to say here, I think I try to say this anytime we have a physician on the program, and we do a lot of shows with doctors, we just like to make sure that people understand we cannot do diagnosis over the telephone because the doctor cannot see you. We do these programs to add to your general store of health knowledge, and basic questions are fine. And I also, of course, don't want to discourage anybody from calling. I just want to make sure people keep in mind the limitations of this format, but certainly your questions are welcome, and I'm sure that Dr. Lipsky would do his best to give you an answer. And Dr. Lipsky, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, and yourself?
Fine, thank you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. Just to review the numbers, this is something that we certainly know. Heart disease is a serious problem in the United States, has been for a while. Tell me, how many Americans will get heart disease?
If you live long enough, you almost undoubtedly will get heart disease. As you pointed out, it's the leading cause of death in the United States. And when you combine vascular disease with heart disease, and they should be thought of combined, and you add stroke, it is also one of the leading causes of disability as well in the country. So its impact is huge.
So we have significant numbers affected, and we certainly know that heart disease and stroke have been serious problems for a while. We have a pretty good handle on what the risk factors are, so I think people have an idea what they should be doing or what they shouldn't be doing. So having said all that, have we, say, look back over the last 10, 20 years or so, maybe even more, have we done anything through the combination of medical care and public education? Have we really done much to put a dent in those numbers?
Well, actually, I think we have in several ways. First, you're beginning to see a decrease in the number of strokes, and that's related to, in fact, that more and more people are aware that high blood pressure is a problem, and more people are seeking treatment. And so certainly we have a long way to go. Only about 30% of people with high blood pressure really have good control of it. But still, again, we've made some improvement. Second area where I think in my lifetime we've seen a huge difference is in the number of people that smoke. And back in the 50s, it was probably over 50% of adults smoked, and now we're down into the 20% range. So I think we're making a fair amount of headway, and certainly most people that I encounter in practice know, for example, what their cholesterol level is, and you know you know, more about the medications. So again, I think we're making progress. We just still have a long way to go.
Yeah, and there, even though we want to make sure people understand what we're going to try to focus on this morning is heart disease, I think that it is true, and you can tell me if I've got this wrong, that as far as stroke is concerned, the risk factors are much the same in both stroke and heart disease.
Yes, absolutely. Because the way I think about it is both of these problems are caused by what we call atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries. And that is a concept that doctors have begun to understand over the last 10 to 20 years, is that if you have your blood vessels affected, it's not limited just to your heart, but it affects all the blood vessels in your body. And so strokes involve neurologic tissue, and so they're related to hardening of the arteries of the vessels that go to the brain.
Mm-hmm. Just one of the things that's clear, and I think probably people understand, is that if we start talking about risk factors for heart disease, one of them is family history. So genes do indeed play a role here. Mm-hmm. If you split out as you're looking at the risk factors, and we'll talk some more about what they are. If you split out lifestyle stuff from heredity stuff, how much of heart disease does indeed have to do with family history, which is something that people don't have that much control over, and how much of it can indeed be determined by the things that
control? How much can you control?
Yeah, yeah.
A couple things, as you're right. Can I quickly review? The risk factors that
yes.
you can't change are, you know, if you're a male, you're more likely to get heart disease at a younger age. And by the way, women are not immune. That's a very important misconception I should erase, mm-hmm. is if you ask women, a lot of people think breast cancer is the leading cause of death for women, but it's not. Far and away, it's heart disease. The difference is for women is they get it 10 years later. They get a buy for the first 10 years. And then certainly as we get older, we get more at risk for heart disease. And if you have a way of not getting older, please let me know, by the way. And heredity. Uh-huh. Things that we can change and we can do things about is we can work on our blood cholesterol. We can work on our blood pressure. Certainly we can try and manage our weight. Have greater physical activity. If we happen to have diabetes, we can work to control our blood sugar. And probably one of the things that I think is so overlooked as an important factor is smoking. If you smoke, the single most important thing you can do for your health is stop smoking. People estimate that two-thirds of the excess mortality in the United States is related to lifestyle. And so it's just such an important issue. If you look at a middle-aged smoker and you get them to stop smoking, you've added 5 years to their life.
We have a call already, and I want to get to this person. I don't want to make him wait, but just very quickly for anybody else who's just tuned in, I'd like to reintroduce the guest. We're talking with Dr. Martin Lipsky. He is a family physician. He is also regional dean at the U of I College of Medicine at Rockford and is one of the authors of a recently published book, The American Medical Association Guide to Preventing and Treating Heart Disease. It's published by Wiley and has a lot of good basic information on the subject. So you might look for it. Look for it in the bookstore. Look for it in the library. And, of course, on the program here, your questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to start with in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. One of the things that seems to be getting more research done on it is heart failure. And it's something that the average consumer hasn't heard very much about. I had a friend who died at 61 of heart failure. And I'm beginning to see more in things like Consumer Reports on Health and so forth about it, as research is beginning to show that a lot of doctors, that it kind of masquerades as other things. And I just saw in the airport, I picked up a USA Today, there was an article, and I don't know how much research is behind it because I haven't seen it anyplace else, about depression causing the heart to develop excess collagen and to stiffen and to cause heart failure. And I just saw something else about undiagnosed sleep apnea being a contributor to heart failure. So I'm wondering if you have any knowledge about this, if your book covers any of that sort of thing, because it seems like that's one of the evolving areas of research and an area that a lot of the public doesn't know much about. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well,
wow.
Dr. Lipsky?
Really good questions. And in fact, there is an entire chapter in this book on heart failure. And the caller is right. It's a very serious condition. And it used to be, and we're doing much, much better with heart failure, is people underestimated what a serious condition it was. And it had a 5-year mortality rate of 50%, which is actually worse than some cancers. So people, I don't think, fully appreciated the importance of heart failure. And I kind of think of it in two things. First, some of the things we know that will help prevent heart failure is by managing high blood pressure over a long period of time. If the heart, which really is just a pump, and the blood vessels are pipes, they act with a high-pressure system. Think about it. That's more wear and tear and stress on the pump. And so controlling your blood pressure is critically important. The second thing is heart disease from narrowing of the coronary arteries, which decreases the blood supply of the heart and leads to heart attacks. Over a period of time, what happens is if you have a heart attack, some of your heart muscle dies, so that portion of the heart muscle doesn't pump as well. And over a period of time, if enough muscle is damaged, the heart will fail. Now, what do we mean by heart failure? Because it's a complicated term. I'd like to take a few moments to talk about what it means. So heart failure means the heart pump isn't pumping as efficiently as it should. And there's two types of symptoms we get from heart failure. The first is if the heart can't pump the blood forward in the right way, you get some symptoms related to a lack of good circulation. And those would be things like your extremities can be cold, you can be weak, you can be dizzy, lots of fatigue. The second type of symptoms that you can get is what we call congestive or backflow systems. That is, if the pump isn't working correctly, there will be fluid that will back up. And the types of symptoms that people get with that can be shortness of breath, difficulty sleeping at night, shortness of breath when they try and exert themselves, swelling in their ankles. So those are some of the symptoms of heart failure. The good news for the reader is we do so much better in terms of the medicines that we have available to treat heart failure, and some of the medicines actually take some of the stress and load off of the heart, and actually well-managed heart failure, we can add years to a person's life once they're diagnosed. And of course, as a family physician, my goal is to prevent it, but if somebody does have heart failure, now there's lots of medications that we can use. Now, the caller has two very interesting things she's raised. One is sleep apnea, and the reader is correct. If that you have long-standing sleep apnea, what happens is you're not oxygenating your bloodstream as well in the evenings when you sleep, and over a period of time, that does create stress on the heart. And we now are much more aware of sleep apnea being a problem. We're much better at diagnosing it, and then there's actually treatments now for sleep apnea that I think help individuals. And the second thing is the correlation with depression. It does look like there is a correlation between depression and heart disease, and it makes intuitive sense if you think about it, because the same stress from depression creates excess of stress hormones, can raise your blood pressure, and it does look like there's more of a connection with the heart and our emotions than was once believed. And if you think about it, probably people understood that far before modern times, because we always used to say things like, The heart is the source of emotions, and there's probably a connection scientifically that we're beginning to appreciate more fully.
Okay, well, I hope that that gets to the question of the caller. Others are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have that toll-free line that's 800-222-9455. One of the risk factors for heart disease, and I'm sure everyone is aware of this, is high blood cholesterol. And it's a message that I think that the health community has been trying to put out for some time now. So let's talk about that and talk about when people have their cholesterol checked, the report that they get back, it's going to give them some numbers, that there's going to be an overall total number, which is one thing that you want to pay attention to, but there also will be numbers for breaking down various components, like people are used to hearing that there's good cholesterol and there's bad cholesterol, and you'd like to have your one to be low and your other to be higher and so forth. So when people have this done, talk a little bit about how to interpret the numbers that they get back.
Sure. Again, very good questions. First, I'll take a second to talk about cholesterol. Mm-hmm. First of all, you want some cholesterol. Cholesterol is an important building block for the body, for making sex hormones and some other important hormones, as well as and it's an essential component of the walls of our blood cells. So you have to have some cholesterol. The problem is if there's too much cholesterol, it begins to deposit in the blood vessel wall, and over a period of time, what happens is this causes a hardening of the arteries and also a narrowing that inhibits a blood flow. And the inhibiting the blood flow is what leads to heart attacks and some of the other problems associated with hardening of the arteries. So that's why cholesterol is bad. And you're right, we look at the total cholesterol, but even more importantly is we also look at how the cholesterol is packaged. And the two types of packages that you'll hear about are the LDL cholesterol and the HDL cholesterol. And the HDL is actually the one that we believe you want a little bit higher, and that's the high-density lipoprotein. And the reason why we think HDL is protective is what happens is the cholesterol circulates in the system. If there's a little extra cholesterol attached to the blood vessel wall, what happens is the body does come around and that scavenges that extra cholesterol and then brings it back to the liver to be processed. So that's why HDL is believed to be helpful, is it kind of soaks up like a sponge extra cholesterol. It's the LDL, or the low-density lipoprotein, that is the one that is the unhappy type of cholesterol. Or what I do is I draw a happy face by the HDL, and the way I remember is happy and H go together. And the LDL is the bad cholesterol. And that's the one that we think is the one that gets deposited in the cell walls. It's the one which triggers inflammatory responses, and we want that a little bit lower. Everybody should have their cholesterol interpreted in context of their health. So, for example, there'd be different desirable levels based on family history, whether or not you've ever had heart disease, but as a general rule, your desirable total cholesterol should be less than 200. Your HDL cholesterol, usually the higher the better, and we worry about HDL cholesterols below 40, and we're happy about or like HDL cholesterols above 60. And for the LDL cholesterol, I mean, optional is low, is less than 100, and most people think between 100 and 130 for your LDL cholesterol is near or just slightly above optimal. Mm. And again, not everybody whose cholesterol is not in the desirable range needs to be on medications, but probably if you're not in the desirable range, it's probably at least a flag that it's even more important for you that you follow the dietary and exercise recommendations that we have for all people, but may be essentially critical for those who have the risk factor of high cholesterol.
Yeah. I have a couple of callers I want to get to. Let me ask you one quick question. Your first line of attack to lower cholesterol and to lower the LDLs is through diet.
Diet, exercise, and if you smoke,
stop smoking.
You're going to hear that come up repeatedly over the course of the day. Those are the sort of the tripod of how to tackle heart disease.
And it seemed like for a long time, from what I could see, the only thing that anybody knew that would effectively raise your HDLs was exercise. Now, so there are some people who are going to be able to make some progress that way. Are there, and at some point, I'm sure we'll probably talk more about medications, are there now some medications that are known to raise HDL levels?
There's no medicine that is very good at raising HDLs. There are a couple of the medications on the market, niacin or nicotinic acid, and the statins do raise it modestly, but the only real effective ways are exercise. By the way, if you smoke and you stop smoking, your HDL will also likely creep up. What's controversial is modest amounts of alcohol may increase HDL. Doctors are very cautious about that association because this is a country where 5 to 10% of the population have drinking-related problems. So doctors are reluctant to say, go out and have a drink, but certainly what I advise my patients is if you enjoy a glass of red wine or white wine, do so in moderation, and it appears that that might be helpful. There was a medication that they were testing in stage 3 trials, and that raised HDL, and to the surprise of everyone, they actually stopped the trial early and withdrew the drug application because while it raised HDL, it actually increased mortality. Hmm. So the HDL picture is kind of complicated, particularly since it looks like there's subfractions of HDL.
Okay, let's go with some more phone callers here. And Urbana is an Urbana caller's next, line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's a thing called metabolic syndrome, and it involves if you have four symptoms, I think, diabetes, belly fat, high cholesterol, and high blood pressure. Well, I was always 3 out of 4 and thought, well, I'm safe because my blood pressure is just great. Well, my blood pressure is creeping up. It's about 130 over 80 an awful lot of the time now. And what do I do to do that, get rid of that? Can diet help that besides just avoiding salt?
Good question. You have a sophisticated group of callers here. Actually, metabolic syndrome is a collection of symptoms that people are questioning is actually really a syndrome or if it's just a collection of symptoms that walk together. I think in some ways, I actually think we should rename metabolic style and call it Western lifestyle syndrome. And so the caller is correct. You can get high blood pressure. You can get problems with your blood sugar. You have lipid disorders. And usually the way your lipid pattern looks with metabolic syndrome is your total cholesterol is high but not terrible. But then you have a very low HDL and usually high triglycerides.
And that's it.
And the single most important marker of that, by the way, in diagnosing it, is what the reader calls is belly fat. If you are a man with a waist over 40 inches or a woman over 35 inches, some people are saying that's almost enough to diagnose the metabolic syndrome. The good news is that trying to increase your physical activity, watching your weight, those are both very helpful. If not making the syndrome and some of the problems go away, making it easier to manage with medications. And certainly a lot of people look at a drug to help control the blood sugar called metformin, and that seems to also help attack the metabolic syndrome. And then usually we try to control the blood pressure with medications, and if need be, treat the lipid or the fat problems with medications as well. Now, I want to tell you that, let's say you go out and exercise, lose weight, and you say, I still have some of these problems, they didn't go completely away. That's still very, very important, because the medications the medications are much more effective when they're combined with lifestyle changes.
Okay. Anything more about diet and blood pressure?
Sure. Blood pressure.
What do you think of 130 over 80? Is that too high?
As you know, you always have to interpret in context with the an individual's health. So, for example, you may have some conditions that make that on the high level. Most people would feel that 130 over 80 with the absence of other problems wouldn't merit medication, but would merit close monitoring and trying to reduce your blood pressure through watching your salt like you're doing. If you lose weight, your blood pressure tends to drift down, and sometimes very modest amounts of weight loss actually translate into decreases in blood pressure. Certainly, if you eat fruits and vegetables, there's what they call a DASH diet, which is the making sure you get plenty of fresh fruits and vegetables, lots of whole grains, limit animal fat, watch your salt. That also can reduce blood pressure. Plus, aerobic exercise over a period of time will also reduce blood pressure. So, again, you probably know that you need to do these things. Doesn't make them easy sometimes to actually have to do them.
Yeah, I feel like I'm struggling with it, and instead of going forward, I'm going backward when I'm seeing my blood pressure going up. All right, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. We are a little bit past our midpoint here. We'll take some more callers in just a second, just as soon as I introduce again the guest, Martin Lipsky. He is a family physician. He's also regional dean at the University of Illinois College of Medicine at Rockford, and is one of the authors of a recently published book that is the American Medical Association Guide to Preventing and Treating Heart Disease. So if you're interested in a good basic book about heart disease and its risk factors and what you can do to prevent it and how it is treated, you can look for the book. It's published by Wiley, and I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore or in the library. And here on the program, of course, questions are welcome. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And our next caller, also someone in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. I want to get back to HDLs. I am 61. I do not smoke. My HDL has been at 40 or 41 or 42 for well over a decade. First topic is niacin. What are the pros and cons of taking a niacin prescription?
Well, first of all, every doctor to a certain degree has their pet drugs, and I do like niacin for many reasons. Niacin will lower your cholesterol. It's not as potent for lowering the cholesterol as much as like the statin drugs. So sometimes I look at the actual total cholesterol level, and if the total cholesterol is not that high...
Mine's 175.
So that's actually pretty good. So I probably, if I'm going to say I'm going to give you a drug and I want to focus on raising your HDL, niacin has the highest percent raise among all the drugs, and it can raise your HDL 5 to 15%.
I missed the suffix. Niacin what?
Niacin raises your HDL more than any of the other drugs on the market,
okay.
But it's only 5 to 15%. So you're looking at, say, an increase of 2 to 6 on your HDL. It's not this huge bump.
Okay.
And there's, you know, you probably, it sounds like you exercise.
I walk a lot. I do not do weight exercises. Is that something I should get into?
The walking will raise your HDL, but again, it's only a modest amount. It's sometimes 2 to 5, and actually, I try and exercise pretty regularly. I try and practice what I preach, and I see that it's bumped my HDL maybe from low 50s to high 50s. It just doesn't do that much. Now, I'm a big fan of weight-bearing and exercise for a couple different reasons. First, it's one of the best things to prevent osteoporosis, which is thinning of the bones.
Okay.
And even though that's more commonly associated with women, men certainly get osteoporosis. The second thing is there's some wonderful benefits to having extra muscle mass and doing a little weight training.
Uh-huh.
First of all, as we get older, it helps us with things like our balance and our mobility and being able to function. The second thing is that muscle mass burns calories faster than fat tissue. And so if you have a fair amount of muscle mass, it raises your basic metabolism rate a bit, and if you exercise, it raises it. And the good news is then you're burning more calories when you're sitting and talking on the phone like this than if you didn't have good muscle mass. So I think that a good exercise program should include some type of weight lifting or some modest type of weight-bearing exercise.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And again, we'll go to another caller. And the next is in Champaign, and this is line number 3. Hello.
Yes, I wanted to ask a question about irregular heartbeat, especially when it is increased over, like, say, when you get to be 60 and over. And I was wondering what the cause, why would you have an irregular heartbeat, and what the consequences are, and then what you can do about it. And if it's all right, I'll just hang up and listen on radio.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Well, thank you for the question. Go ahead, Dr. Lipsky.
Irregular heartbeats are really complex, so I'm probably going to give you a little bit of a oversimplification, and I encourage you to work with your doc about irregular heartbeats. In fact, arrhythmias, which basically means your heart rhythm isn't regular, are so complicated that it's actually now a subspecialty of cardiology to manage these. First of all of us will have a certain number of irregular heartbeats, and oftentimes they are perfectly normal. And so people who have very healthy hearts that occasionally skip a heartbeat, and sometimes we can even feel that in our chest as a palpitation, that's usually not serious, and frequently responds to just some things like reducing the amount of caffeine in our diet. As people get older, they're more prone to missed heartbeats or racing hearts, etc. And so one of the key things are, what are the symptoms associated with an arrhythmia or irregular heartbeat? For example, if you're feeling that and getting very dizzy or having chest pain or shortness of breath associated with that, you certainly need a doctor's evaluation to kind of sort that out. And so symptoms associated with an irregular heartbeat does make us a little bit more anxious about what the cause is. And then when you say irregular heartbeat, there's all sorts of types of these arrhythmias. You can have where your heart goes too slow, and sometimes that can be related to medications, or occasionally it's a normal consequence of aging. Sometimes people's heart rates are slow because they're in good physical condition. So a marathoner sometimes has resting heart rates down in the 30s. Again, that's actually probably a good thing. So you always have to view these things in the context of the patient. But sometimes people with very, very slow heart rates actually need a pacemaker to speed their heart rate up. Occasionally, heart rates go way, way too fast, and there's a fast type of heart rhythm called atrial fibrillation, which is very common in older individuals. 5% of individuals over 65 suffer from atrial fibrillation. And so there we are looking at issues of rate control, trying to keep the heart from going too fast. And also in atrial fibrillation, we sometimes look at thinning the blood because it can be a risk factor for stroke. Then you have people who miss heartbeats or skip heartbeats, and those are really complex in sorting out as to whether or not the irregular heartbeat originates from the upper part of the heart, the atria, or the lower part of the ventricle. And frequently, we need to do a lot of tests to determine whether or not those are serious or need treatment.
All right. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Martin Lipsky. He's a family physician. He's also regional dean at the U of I College of Medicine in Rockford and one of the authors of a recently published book, The American Medical Association Guide to Preventing and Treating Heart Disease. And that's what we're talking about here this morning. And if you have questions, give us a call. I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Monticello is the next caller, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I have a question about hypertension and have a bit of history with that. And I've been doing some research online and am coming across some interesting studies through Mayo Clinic where they are working with patients on breathing techniques. And what they're doing is basically sitting these folks down for about 15-minute periods of time, maybe three times a day, and working on very rhythmic breathing techniques. And they're seeing very good results. And I'm wondering if you're hearing about this and what you think of it.
Another good question. I'm not familiar with that particular study and exactly what they're doing. But what I can say is that I am familiar with biofeedback, which again is a relaxation technique, and it may be these breathing techniques are similar to that. And we do know that you can, excuse me, that these modalities do lower blood pressure. And so I think the wonderful things about techniques like that is they're so risk-free. So, for example, if you can learn some simple breathing techniques and they lower blood pressure, that's just so exciting for us because all the medications that we use have the risk for side effects and can be very expensive. And so one of my things I'm going to do is I will probably try to learn a little bit more about that study myself.
Great. They're saying that they're seeing many of the patients being able to drop off the medications. Even folks that were on very high doses. So it was very interesting. Thought I'd mention it.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. I just, here for a second, you know, we've been talking a lot about risk factors, and particularly here recently we talked about two things, high blood pressure and high blood cholesterol. And we've talked about the fact that there are things that people can do, lifestyle-oriented things that they can do, to try to improve those. And I'm sure that with the physicians, when you sit down with the patient and if you have somebody who does have high blood pressure or blood cholesterol, those are the first things that you're going to talk to them about. At some point, for either or both of these, it's possible then you're going to start talking about using medication to get them down into the range where you would like. How exactly do you go about making that decision about to put somebody on medication for one of these, or I suppose it's possible for both?
I think it's a conjoint decision with the physician and the patient. And I always view particularly managing blood pressure and cholesterol, which are usually chronic, long-term problems, it's a partnership between the physician and the patient. So that's my philosophy. And my goal is to make my patient informed and educated and provide information that they can make a good decision. With that said, I think there are certain levels of blood pressure that are sufficiently high enough that it's pretty clear that the benefits of taking a medication and lowering your blood pressure outweigh its risks. And that's my job to try and do that. The same thing for cholesterol. There comes a point in time where it's high enough where it's pretty clear that we can lower your risk. And again, there's numerical guidelines. So for cholesterol, we look at if the LDL level is over 190, even in the absence of other risk factors, we begin to think that that's such a high range, we need to start to think about bringing it down. So there's are some absolute numbers that are so high. And then I think we really try to individualize it to every single patient. So, for example, I just had a person show me their cholesterol, and it's really on the borderline as to whether or not you could treat it. It's one of the areas where it's suboptimal, and you have to weigh the benefits of the medication versus the risk. And sometimes then I look at history, whether or not they have side effects with the medications. And it's a complex decision when you put people on a medication. For the most part, the medications are safe. They work pretty well. But if you have a side effect, it doesn't help when I say the side effect is only seen in 5% of people. For you, it's 100%. So I really do think it's a partnership, and a lot of times patients that I see with blood pressure, say, of consistently 140 over 90 or higher, that's kind of in the very low range that we would usually recommend treatment. A lot of people are reluctant to go on treatment, and I will probably work with them over a period of weeks with diet, exercise, watching your salt. And a lot of times if we do it right, we conjointly make a decision that the lifestyle changes aren't working and that you do need to go into medication.
Okay. We have several callers here. We'll try to get them all in. Next up is someone in Savoy, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of three questions, if you can kind of bear with me. The first one is, you mentioned about the irregular heartbeat, and my husband was diagnosed with PD about 3 years ago. Up to that point, he had a very strong and very regular heartbeat, and I noticed after he started on his medication at some point that he had developed an irregular heartbeat, which if he skips a beat, it'll go ba-boom, boom, ba-boom, boom. And it's been very consistent, and his family practice doctor said it was not anything to worry about and didn't refer him to anybody else. So that's my first question. Is it nothing to worry about, or should we be seeing a cardiologist, a specialist, to make sure?
This would be one where I can't give you a clear-cut answer for an individual, but I could give you some guidelines.
Okay.
First of all, a lot of times they are nothing to worry about. And, I don't refer every patient who has an irregular heartbeat to a cardiologist. And, again, I'm a family physician. But I will say is this, is I think if you have any concerns about what a doctor tells you, and this is a general rule, and you feel like you'd like to get a second opinion, I strongly encourage patients to do that. Your physician should not be afraid if you get a second opinion. So if you came to me and as a family physician say, I'm concerned that this may be something to worry about, I'd like to see a cardiologist, I usually tell them and say, tell you what, I'm happy to do so. And a couple things is what I tell the patient. If you find out that I'm right, then hey, you're reassured. I feel like I've got a second opinion. That's great. If you find out that I'm not right, then I say to myself, thank God we sent you to somebody who's smarter than me that figured it out. Now, occasionally you do run into situations where doctors disagree because for some things, it isn't always straightforward what to do, and there can be an element of judgment as to what's the best course of action.
Okay, and I didn't know if it was related to the PD medication or even PD itself, but I don't think so because PD isn't supposed to affect the heart.
By PD, you mean Parkinson's disease?
Yes.
Okay. You're right. Some of the Parkinson's medications can trigger irregular heartbeats here and there.
Okay. All right. And can I move on to my next question?
Sure.
I'm one of those people that I can't figure it out. I weigh 110. I've always maintained that level of weight, 114. I've been drinking skim milk for years. I eat shredded wheat for breakfast. I eat Great Northern beans for lunch and whole wheat bread. And my cholesterol has been high, and I've been treated with Lipitor for several years. And I can't, and I move around the house. I don't jog or do a lot of heavy aerobics, but I'm a homemaker, and I'm on my feet most of the day doing one thing or another or running errands. So I'm on my feet pretty much from 9 to 5, and I cannot figure out why I have a high cholesterol problem, except that it's in my family. Is that what it is?
You know, I think you picked the wrong parents is what I tell people, and you're doing all the right things, and even so, sometimes your cholesterol will be high. And I can sympathize with you because I don't know that I do quite as well in my lifestyle as you do, but as I picked the wrong father, and so I have his cholesterol pattern, and in fact, my triglycerides are very, very low, which reflects, I think, good diet, but I can't bring my cholesterol down. Don't get discouraged because even though it's not where it should be when you do all those things, it might be actually even 100 points higher if you did none of those things.
Right, and I'm on the statin drug too, 10 milligrams, so, and that helps keep it down. But it's just discouraging because, you know, here you're doing all the right things. My blood pressure's good. It's always a steady 120 over 75 or 80. It's pretty decent, so... Well, okay.
Well, let's sympathize together because I share the same similar problem, and I think our listeners shouldn't lose track that, yeah, it's psychologically hard to go on a medication. I had to go out and buy a pill box. It's very disconcerting, and part of my interest in kind of lifestyle managing in this, in lipids and what to do with blood pressure is because of these illnesses happen to run in my family.
Okay. Well, thank the caller, and I hope she will forgive me. I want to try and get at least one more, and we'll go next to the caller on line two, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I came in a little bit late, and I apologize if I missed this, and you answered part of it a little earlier, but it seems like a number of years back we used to hear a lot more about the ratio between the HDL and the LDL and the total cholesterol and all that, and we're not hearing so much about that anymore. Is that no longer considered? I have a family member who has almost 300 for total, but yet HDLs are at 91, who's also reluctant to go on medication, is a musician, is concerned about the muscle consequences of statins, and I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit.
Yes, we still look at the ratio, and we try and see that it's less than 4 to 1. But you're right, we have steered a little away from the ratio, and usually what we do is you make your treatment decisions primarily based first on the LDL levels. And if you're, you look at the LDL levels, you look at the number of risk factors, you get to sometimes subtract a risk factor if your HDL is high. So I do think you're right that there's been a shift from the consensus guidelines talking more about LDL levels than ratio. So that's a good point. Hey, I always wonder what to do with these people that have very high cholesterols and high HDLs. And usually if you follow the guidelines, what you would do is you look at the LDL levels, then you look at the number of risk factors that they have, and they kind of spell out when you should treat or where is it's a little grayer and it's a joint decision. And so you certainly, with a HDL of 90, you would subtract one of your risk factors.
Okay. Okay. And how about the consequences of statins and the possible muscle weakness, pain kind of thing? Is that reversible if you stop the statins?
Yes. Most people think it's reversible. And a lot of people are wondering how real that myopathy or muscle effect of statins is. And you know, I'll tell you what, you're always influenced by what I call anecdotal information, like you had a patient, or in my case, I got to tell you, I happen to take statins, and it may be in my mind, but I'm convinced sometimes I get a little bit more achy when I take them. Probably for most people, they're very, very safe, and usually we don't even monitor enzymes that are muscle enzymes unless people are having symptoms. So I think if you really need to take the medication, I would say you should go ahead and try it.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Oakwood for a caller. Line three. Hello.
Yes. Enjoy the program. I had a bypass in 06, triple bypass, and I'm on cholesterol medicine. Have been for a long period of time. I was on cholesterol medicine even before I had my bypass. But I run into the same problem of having muscle aches after I'm on that certain statin or whatever else drug that they put me on. After a period of time, I get so I can't hardly get out of a bed in the morning. I have flu-like symptoms, ache all over. So what's my next step in this cholesterol drug taking?
Yeah, there are other medications besides statins, and if you just can't tolerate or can't take it for some reason, you have to look at some of those other medications. And I tell you, I'm old enough that I remember before there were statins, we used these medications a fair amount. And so the reason why people like statins is for the most part, and of course, as I said, if you have the side effect, it's 100% for you. Most people do very, very well, and there's nothing near as potent. But there are other medications that would work, and you may be on some of those. There's something called ezetimibe or Zetia.
Yes,
that will lower cholesterol. Nicotinic acid or niacin, that will lower cholesterol. In the old days, and I go back to those old days, there's what we call the bile resins. Those lower cholesterol and are actually pretty effective, but a lot of people used to have side effects in terms of bloating and constipation. The other thing is they can be a little complicated to take because you have to sometimes separate when you take them from other medications because they can interfere with the medication absorption. And then there is also Lopid and some of those medications, which tend to work a little bit better on triglycerides but will also lower cholesterol. So you got about four other medications that can potentially lower your cholesterol levels.
We're going to have to stop here. I've got to jump in. I'm sorry. We've just used our time for the present. We'll have to stop. But again, if people are interested in more information on this subject, you might look for the book that I hear mentioned a couple of times. It's the AMA, the American Medical Association Guide to Preventing and Treating Heart Disease. And our guest, Dr. Martin Lipsky, is a family physician. He's a regional dean at the U of I College of Medicine in Rockford and is one of the authors. And Dr. Lipsky, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Hopefully this was helpful for your listeners.
Programs here on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting A Springtime of Classical Music with the Orion String Quartet, Zolt Bognar, the Kronos Quartet, and Anton Querty. More information available at krannertcenter.com. We're going to break for an update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Lernard Seed Service, an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products to farmers in East Central Illinois. Lernard Seed Service provides customer services and agronomic information to help customers maximize profits. Lernard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Let's go right to the prices. We're in Kansas City. March wheat is trading at $13.33, up 18. July, $12.85, up 7.25. At the Chicago Board of Trade, March wheat trading at $12.72, up 2. May, $12.88.25, up 5.75. July, trading at $12.44.75, down 0.25. March